Let me tell you what crappy coffee is all about. It's all about this swill that's a regular shit machine. I'm talking morning, day, night, afternoon, shit, 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 shit.
How many shits is that?
A lot. Until one day, you order up spark plug coffee and it's like, whoa, baby. I mean, this coffee is like George Clooney in Ocean's 11. Smooth as glass. So then you're drinking something you ain't tasting in forever. Good. Good. True. Toby, true. It works. It works for you. It shouldn't work so good. It's just a beverage. But when you drink this stuff, you feel it, just like you did the first time. You see, spark plug is reminding your tongue what it was once like to taste the good stuff. Hence, like a spark plug.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hey there, Diamond Thieves. Welcome to our podcast that continues on past our completion of the American Film Institute's Bestest American Movies with the Next 100 Project. If spoilers ain't your thing, stop listening to us, motherfuckers. My Christian name is Ryan Ellis, alias Mr. Fuchsia, with my partner in botched crimes, alias Mr. Chartreuse, Bev.
That's me.
Okay, the coming attractions trivia for this week's picture. It is Reservoir Dogs. Quentin Tarantino is famous for making pop culture references. Which three of these nine are not name-dropped in Reservoir Dogs? Marlon Brando, Elvis Presley, Lee Marvin, Aretha Franklin, The Lost Boys, Pam Grier, Superman, The Great Escape, and The Fantastic Four.
So when we had just watched the movie, I heard this trivia for the first time. I was like, this is going to be easy, but now it's been a week. Aretha Franklin?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Marlon Brando?
No, he is mentioned.
Damn it. Okay, and Superman.
Superman's also correct. The third is Elvis Presley.
Oh.
Marlon Brando's mentioned when Randy Brooks is telling Tim Roth how to be an undercover cop. You got to be like Marlon Brando in this job.
Oh, yes, I remember now.
Bad actor's bullshit in this job.
Damn.
So Tarantino's script does name drop all those other people. And one of the reasons I chose Superman is because he's mentioned in the Kill Bill movie, Kill Bill 2 at least.
Yeah.
Elvis, of course, is mentioned in Pulp Fiction.
That's part of Quentin Tarantino's signature. The guy's a pop culture guru. Whether it's highbrow or lowbrow, he seems to treat them all equally. And he just loves to have his characters talk about them.
And whoever's listening to this podcast, if they're a fan of this film and know it well, pick out those six names and try to place where they are in the movie because they're all in there.
A couple of them are easy. The Pam Grier is obviously the conversation in the car. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's the only one I can remember now. It's been a piece since I saw the movie. Damn.
Okay, listeners, it's up to you to figure out where those references are, but they're all in there. Minus Presley, Superman, and Aretha Franklin. So, the next 100 Project's third movie, Reservoir Dogs, was first shown at Sundance on January 21st, 1992. So this is the prestigious 24th anniversary.
Yes.
It was also screened at Cannes and the Toronto International Film Festival later that year, much like Pulp Fiction a few years later, a festival hit, then released in October, both Pulp and Dogs before it. This movie had a minuscule budget, but turned a bit of a profit. Now, Bev, why don't you tell the listeners what really happened?
What for? It's just going to be more bullshit.
That's a pretty good skinny. Or in a nutshell, Wisconsin crook murders two friends, then follows that up by murdering police officer. The movie's over and everybody we care about is either dead or caught by the cops. If you listen closely, Mr. Pink is being captured.
Because he's the rational one. He wouldn't get himself killed. He understands always what the best thing is for himself and the best thing. And it's better for him to get arrested than get killed.
He is a professional.
Yes.
Okay, some numbers before we get into the conversation. Rotten Tomatoes critics, 92% of them like this film. 56 fresh, 5 rotten, and 94% of audiences. However, two famous critics at the time, and you can find this link on YouTube, and I'll try to find one to put on the website, Gene Siskel, Roger Ebert, not fans. They didn't dislike it in the sense of, oh, piece of shit, but they were not fans either. They thought the potential was there, and then, of course, they both loved Pulp Fiction 2 years later, but they were thumbs down. Empire Magazine calls it the greatest independent movie of all time.
I think part of the reason is because I read some of the bad reviews for the film. It seems as though it was one of those films that was a victim of its own hype. It was such a big deal and people were praising it so much that I guess some people had backlash against it, saying, you know what, it's not as great as you think it is. It's a stylistically excellent film and the dialogue is great and the direction is great, but they all have the same complaint that it's a little shallow. The characters don't really get that much deeper than the situation that they're in.
Especially the lead character, Tim Roth, who yes. effectively is our hero. A few more numbers. 77th, this movie is, on the IMDb 250. Pulp Fiction and Django Unchained for Tarantino movies outrank it, but no other Tarantinos do. And those are some beloved titles he's got on there, including the Kill Bill films, which are your favorites.
Yes, they are.
On the QT scale. And Reservoir Dogs was 136th at the 1992 U.S. box office. That's the lowest number I think I've ever said for a year at the box office. Aladdin was number one. However, Reservoir Dogs was big in England.
Like, even almost then. 10 times the profit in England when you adjust for currencies. Made £6.5 million.
All right, so a mystery whodunit. That's what this movie is. Who really is
Who's the rat? Rat?
It's set and filmed in L.A. Not a lot of movies we've covered on the Top 100 project have been set in L.A. Okay, Bev, you're up. What are your thoughts on Reservoir Dogs?
I was born at the perfect time for Reservoir Dogs to impress me. Like, I was 15 years old and a budding film snob when I first saw it. Came when I was 14, but by the time it made it to the crappy small town I was brought up in the video store, I was 15. And when I first saw it, I didn't have the foggiest notion of all the work it was borrowing from because I was so young, but it made a huge impression on me and it helped open that door to the world of movies outside of Hollywood. But there were a lot of movies that did that for me back then. This one has really stood up. I think Tarantino did more than make something fun and gutsy and different. He made something great and lasting. It is still clever, ruthless, and a blast to watch.
And wasn't originally one of your choices for the month Obev.
That's true. We just got it on Blu-ray, so...
We watched it out of interest, and we thought, why don't we make this one of our podcasts the early part of the year?
It also happens to be one of those movies that when you, the listeners, write to us, it's a frequent request. Mm-hmm. And it's just so fun to watch, but it's also really fun to talk about.
Talk. Talk, talk, talk. Last week's movie, Before Sunrise, was all about talking.
That's so true. Two characters. Yeah.
And now Tarantino's best attribute. As good as he is at choreographing action in Kill Bill and his other recent movies, actually, Inglourious Basterds, Django Unchained, we haven't seen it yet, but The Hateful Eight, the thing he'll always be known for is people talking, usually about stupid bullshit. And the opening of this movie, which I already parodied in the spark plug sponsor at the top of the show, is about people bullshitting. We don't even know then what they're doing. They're all in these suits except for Eddie and for his father, Joe Cabot. That's maybe part of the whole mystery thing of this, too. That also happens in Pulp Fiction because we see, after the very opening with Tim Roth and Amanda Plummer, then we get the conversation Royale with Cheese, which is so famous, with Travolta and Sam Jackson. So this guy who loves his diners opens both movies in a diner, but the key conversations are people who are going to work. Mm-hmm. Criminal activities. Horrible shit. People we shouldn't like. People we shouldn't root for. Most of that time are talking about nothing. And that's what's so cool and that's what's so great.
Yeah, that smart, rough, realistic rat-a-tat dialogue was Tarantino's first calling card. Before he had budgets and before he was a household name, you couldn't talk about the film without talking about the way he inserted these great scenes of characters just bullshitting with each other and dropping all those cultural references. We talked about this when we did the Pulp Fiction podcast about how all those dialogue scenes aided the development of the characters. I think that's something that he developed in Pulp Fiction, but probably wasn't quite there yet with Reservoir Dogs.
No.
I don't think that these conversations do much to reveal much about the characters, but it does really set the tone, and what a great tone.
This set Tarantino's tone, and he's gone back to similar themes and styles ever since. Maybe he would have anyway, but he probably realized, this is what I can do well. Even his screenplays that he didn't direct, True Romance and mm-hmm. Natural Born Killers, now that one was really changed by Oliver Stone. You see some of the same kinds of things done the same kind of way by other directors. And Tony Scott said, thank you, Quentin, for the best screenplay I've ever had, at least back in 1983 when he did True Romance.
Yeah, he can really write realistic, interesting dialogue. His characters, you don't learn a ton about them in Reservoir Dogs, but you do learn that they're smart, and that does make you want to pay attention to them and root for them.
And how clever is this? Fans of the movie are going to know this. This is not news, but we never see the heist.
Yeah.
Or even the diamonds, which are the whole point of the movie in the first place. You do see the outside of the diamond store when Mr. Orange and Mr. White are scoping it, but never the inside itself.
Yeah, he cited various reasons for doing that, that he thought it would make the film more interesting and just get to the focus of what was really important in the story he was telling. But truthfully, he didn't show the heist because he didn't have the budget.
Unlike Heat, which is all about that middle sequence. People like Heat a lot, Pacino and De Niro and all those great actors. But when people think about the movie, they almost always come back to that robbery in the middle of the film. Unlike most movies, not the beginning and the ending, like Saving Private Ryan, for example. It's the middle that people think about the most. And that's not in this film. maybe effectively because it's also described so well.
Mm-hmm.
We can picture Michael Madsen shooting people indiscriminately.
Bang! Bang! Bang!
And we can picture White and Orange getting out somehow. We can picture Mr. Pink blasting his way out. We do see him. He's the only one from the robbery scene right outside, apparently, who's running away from cops and shooting at them. We see White and Orange and Brown, who are a little further away by the looks of it. And by the way, in that sequence is pointed out online, and I look for this, that when Mr. White shoots those cops and Mr. Orange has that conflicted look on his face because, of course, they're killing people that he works with,
yeah.
But he can't blow his cover, when they start walking down the alley, there are people in the background just drinking coffee. It's probably crew people, but maybe it's regular people, but it's just funny to think, this guy just shot his gun many times,
yeah.
And there are people that are in the background enjoying a drink.
Yeah, like they didn't hear anything going on.
Low budget
movie. Yeah, $1.5 million he made this movie for. He was going to make the movie for $30,000 initially when he had the script. He was going to shoot it black and white, 16mm, guerrilla style. His producer, Lawrence Bender, was going to even play a part of the movie.
Nice guy, Eddie.
Yeah.
And Tarantino wanted to play Mr. Pink. He always wanted to play Mr. Pink until he saw Steve Buscemi and thought, he's better than me.
Right decision.
So I will scale back and be Mr. Brown because, as we all know, despite the fact he doesn't want to admit it, Quentin Tarantino is not a good actor.
He's great at what he does, but perhaps putting himself in his movies is not always the wisest choice. It certainly wasn't in Pulp Fiction.
He does sound like Mr. Shit.
So he was going to make the movie for $30,000. He was ready to go. Harvey Keitel got his hands on the script for one reason or another. Loved it. Decided he wanted to not just be in it, but co-produce it. Mm-hmm. And he managed to get the budget up to $1.5 million.
The story goes that his wife, I think it was involved in somehow with Lawrence Bender's acting class. Either she taught it or she knew somebody. And hey, if you are talented, I don't have a problem with this. It's who you know. Because that's what it was for Bender and Tarantino.
Yeah.
If it's who you know and you don't have any talent, then fuck you. But if you're actually good and you happen to have a contact that knows Harvey Keitel, mm-hmm. please benefit from that. That's the way the world works, and good for them that they had that in the first place. And Keitel, as we said in Pulp Fiction, is the one who got Bruce Willis involved in that film because he said, I worked with this kid a couple years ago. He's really good. You're going to want to be with him too. But he wouldn't have been had his kids not played with Harvey Keitel's kids and they're saying on some beach, yeah, this young kid, work with him. But that's Harvey Keitel for you.
Mm-hmm.
He's often worked with directors who are nobodies. Or if they're not fully nobodies, they're just not big players. He isn't just going with the big names. He's not going with the safe projects. The year after this movie, he does The Piano with Jane Campion, mm-hmm. where he's naked, as he was in many movies, actually.
Yeah.
Bad Lieutenant,
yeah.
The same year as this with Abel Ferreira. But Keitel takes those chances and throws himself out there. But then he finds, and maybe it wasn't really him that found him, but helps this young kid make this small-budget movie into something successful. Had he not been involved, maybe none of us would ever have seen it.
You know, he's had kind of a blessed career in that he's been able to take these chances and have these exciting, fun, interesting roles that he's done. He's always still been, maybe not necessarily a leading man, certainly not like a big Hollywood star, but I'm sure that man makes a living making cool, memorable films and obviously doing what he loves, if this is the choices he's making.
I think he does the smart thing. He takes the payday roles, like in U-571, I'm thinking of that one. No one remembers him in that movie. But then he can go and shovel money into other things based on that kind of paycheck. The guy's in Taxi Driver, in a small role. He maybe could have played the main role, and that's what Scorsese wanted to do at first, was he would have been Travis Bickle. The studio said, no, De Niro, the Godfather 2 guy, he's got to be your star. But Keitel was fine taking the pimp role, and everybody remembers him in that pimp role.
Yeah.
He could have been the Albert Brooks character. He picked the right character to play instead as the pimp, and he was great. And then, of course, he's in Pulp Fiction too. So he's in two AFI films, but a lot of his most memorable films are not AFI movies. Either it's bigger roles or smaller ones, in more interesting projects and kind of stuff that if film buffs were to be judging all this shit, they would say, Bad Lieutenant, man, look at that. He's putting himself out there. But he's not our lead. It's Tim Roth.
Mm-hmm.
And Tim Roth, and I'll say this as I said on the Godfather movies and a lot of the crime films we've covered, in this world, he is the bad guy.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because he's the one who can't be trusted. And when he says at the end, Larry, I'm a cop. I'm sorry. I think I have that right. It's Larry, I'm a cop, and then the sorry comes later. What does I'm sorry mean? I'm sorry I betrayed you? I'm sorry I'm a cop? I kind of wish I was more like you in the end? What does it really mean exactly? He's been shot twice. The woman who plugged him in the gut, and then Joe Cabot shooting him, and obviously he's a bad shot. He didn't actually finish him off. Does Mr. White even finish him off when he shoots him in the head, or seems to? But what does that really mean? I'm sorry, I'm betraying you as a friend. You've told me who you really are. But he doesn't seem to have any real problems with that when he's talking to Marvin Nash about how they're going to get Joe, not realizing or maybe not revealing at that moment to Marvin Nash, the cop who's stuck in that chair, that this guy I become friends with, he's also got to go down.
Well, I think he's apologizing to Mr. White specifically, because Mr. White is, of all the gangsters, the only one that seems to have a proper conscience. He's the only one that seems to have a code outside of don't betray gangsters. He doesn't approve of killing people, whether it be civilians or cops, and he takes really good care.
No.
That's true. He's
this
okay with killing
conversation
cops.
With Mr. Pink. Did you kill anybody?
Real people or cops?
Just cops, no real people.
Yeah.
But continue.
Okay, fine. But it's still like a gangster's code. Mm-hmm. Certain lives are more valuable to him than others. He's very upset about Mr. Blonde just going off. And you could even say that Mr. Orange's presence, his betrayal of this gang, is the reason why Mr. Blonde went off. If he hadn't been there, if that heist had just gone off the way that they planned it, nobody would have died. Just some diamonds would have gotten stolen.
That's true, because as Mr. White and Mr. Pink talk about, the cops just show up. But how did that happen? They wouldn't have been there that quickly, as Mr. Pink points out. The alarm would have given them a few minutes, but they're there. Mm-hmm. Because, of course, Mr. Orange has tipped them off to be there in the first place. Mm-hmm. But then Joe Cabot fucks up. He's the only one I wasn't 100% on. That's your proof! You don't need proof when you got instinct.
But Joe's instinct is dead on, and it's funny, at that point in the film, you know that Joe's right, and you are so desperately want Tim Roth to make it. Or you do, especially if you were me when I was younger, because Tim Roth, I had such a crush on him.
You explained to me why you said that. I know he's a good-looking guy back in that era, but the one scene in particular that put you over the top, and it was...
when he's psyching himself up in the mirror before he goes out. You're a tough guy, they have no idea.
Another pop culture reference. What TV show, what cop character is mentioned?
Oh, shit, I can't remember.
You're Beretta. You're so fucking cool.
Yeah, Beretta. Yeah. When he's in the mirror saying, you're so fucking cool.
And he's actually very terrified.
Yes.
You may swoon. That guy's balls are shriveled up back into his body because he's so scared of what might actually really happen to him. And he's going after that meeting where we see the, my way or the highway. And this character, Mr. Orange, Freddie Neuendijk, could have been played by James Woods. That's the urban legend. I think it's true. I've read this in many places. James Woods' agent did not even pass on the screenplay because, of course, Tarantino was a nobody. And when James Woods found out a year or two later, he fired his agent. Because he thought, I wish I'd been in that fucking movie. They were probably better off by getting the Englishman who's playing this American and so well, actually, the unknown. Woods was maybe a little bit too well known. He might have been the biggest name in the cast, at least at that time, had he been in the cast. And maybe it would have been a giveaway that he's actually the rat. But I want to get back to your favorite scene, the Beretta thing, where he knocks up with a change and a wedding ring comes out of there. I don't know if that really means a lot, but it's been interesting to me to watch the movie as a married man now the last couple of years. I haven't seen the movie in a while. Is he actually married, or is it his front? It seems to be
it's his front,
because why would he not have the ring on and take it off if he was trying not to play a married guy?
Yeah, and if you were actually married and you took your ring off from time to time, you probably wouldn't keep it in a jar with a pile of change either. It's a prop.
But why?
Because it's his front. I don't know why you would want to appear to be married.
We said this on Pulp Fiction. There are so many subplots upon the subplots upon the subplots of Quentin Tarantino's screenplays.
Pulp Fiction, he did it much better, where there's a real implied
the Gimp
world.
Especially.
Yeah, an implied past that he doesn't embellish. He just gives you these hints and little bits and pieces everywhere. Reservoir Dogs, you can see a little bit of that, but he really perfected that in Pulp Fiction.
But then this movie starts the whole trend of recurring names. The Vegas. Vic Vega in this movie is Mr. Blonde, Michael Madsen, Vincent Vega, and Reservoir Dogs. There was going to be a movie with them as brothers. Never materialized and never will now, I don't think. And then Dimmick. That is Larry, Mr. White's name. Lawrence Dimmick. That's also the last name of Jimmy, Quentin Tarantino's character in Pulp Fiction. And then if you look through all the other movies, either they are in the same time frame or they're many years before, because he's done so many movies now. Glorious Bastards, Django Unchained, and as I said, we haven't seen Hateful Eight. There's probably something else in there with a last name, or maybe even a first and last name, that match up to a character we've seen in his early movies. So they actually came before, if you know what I mean. So there's these people that may have been grandfathers or granddaughters or whatever that are in the Tarantino universe. Low budget. Let's get back to that for a second. Some of these guys wear their own clothes. And Mr. Blonde's stolen car is Michael Madsen's actual car, where he's got the cop and the trunk. And this is the origin of the trunk shot. I think it's been in most Tarantino movies. It couldn't have been in some of his old ones, of course. No cars. But then that camera that looks straight up at somebody. Dogs, Pulp Fiction, Jackie Brown,
definitely.
Kill Bill and on.
Yeah.
People looking up at somebody who is threatening them from a trunk.
You were talking about wardrobe earlier. One of my favorite touches of the film is that nice guy Eddie is the worst dresser of the bunch of them. He's their boss, and they're all dressed in these suits, and they all look like slumping. Although I noticed Tim Roth is wearing black jeans instead of black slacks.
Steve Buscemi's wearing black jeans, I read.
Oh, is that right? Mm-hmm. They really are just thugs that are dressed up because Joe told them to dress like that for the robbery.
They're playing a role. They have to
they're playing a role, exactly.
We said Heat a few minutes ago. Those guys all dress the same, and until the very last second, that's when they put on the ski masks. But before then, they just blend in. They're just dressed in suits.
Yeah, and it helps to dress all alike because it stops people from reliably IDing you. Mm-hmm. Confuses people when, like, you don't have an outfit to serve as a connection with how somebody looks. It reminded me of when I used to do theater and you would have to wear these costumes and they'd say wear black pants, but you know, people would just wear the worst black, whatever black pants they had, and they're not going to spend money on a new pair of black pants. And it kind of reminded me of that, but it plays with the characters. It works with characters. Exactly.
Well, again, Tarantino, as he said recently in some interview promoting Hateful Eight, you're always aware you're watching a movie. When people say, you shouldn't be reminded you're watching a movie, I know I'm in a theater watching a fucking movie. And same with this thing. These people are playing characters. They're playing roles. Especially Mr. Orange. He's got to be Marlon Brando, because he's an undercover cop. Why not have it be that these guys are dressing up as characters in this little facade?
Mm-hmm. If you're Nice Guy Eddie, or even Joe, they are not dressed nice, because they don't have to. They're the boss. They wear whatever the hell they want. And that's something you see later in The Sopranos, where, especially in the first couple of seasons, all the guys just wear the designer tracksuits that are so ugly, but I guess in New Jersey at the time, they were a thing.
I think that in Sopranos, and Goodfellas too, we talked about that on that podcast, that these people aren't doing as well as the Godfather-level people are, where they can dress in absolutely precision suits. These guys, Donnie Brasco is another one, are just getting by in the mob world. And sometimes their working life is harder than you and I will ever experience, even though they're criminals and they can just work wherever they want to and steal stuff. But that's why they dress like that. And in many cases, because that's the best they can do. And they think it's good enough, or they think it's classy. And actually, it looks like dog shit.
It could have just been a touch that conveniently worked because they just couldn't afford proper costumes for everybody with their small budget.
Another excuse, maybe, yeah. Well, nice touches are bound in this whole film, and you've got some good ones as far as colors go, because when the badly dressed nice guy Eddie is driving after the heist has gone bust, and he's on the phone with Dom, you see this orange balloon that's in the backdraft of his car. And Tarantino said, we need to reshoot that. And somebody else said, no, that'd be kind of cool. We left that in there. It's because Mr. Orange is the rat, and he's talking about what really happened. And Tarantino apparently realized at that point, well, maybe we'll go with that. Yeah, it's, all these film geeks like me can analyze what this scene really means. But it was just some random balloon that got in the shot. Lucky break.
Orange is also prison colors. So maybe that's why Mr. Orange is called Mr. Orange in the first place. Because he's going to try and put them all in prison.
Oh, okay.
Maybe.
Mr. Orange. Well, sticking with the color theme and nice touches. When we've got Mr. Pink and Mr. White in the, not even the bathroom, but the, what is that? The embalming room, I think it is, of the mortuary. You see the white, pink, and orange liquids. Is it soap? Well, some kind of thing in the embalming room. And white and pink are nearby. Orange is further away. Well, Mr. Orange is on that loading dock, maybe 20 feet away at the most. Probably hearing this conversation. Because maybe he's pretending to be more knocked out than he really is. He probably should be dead, or at least very badly hurt. But when he shoots Mr. Blonde, maybe he's been with it all the time. Putting on a bit of an act for Mr. White. But that's a nice touch, too, where they've got the colors of white and pink on one side. And Mr. Orange over there. So when they're talking about a rat in that entire sequence, visually, the movie's telling you, that's the guy. Mm-hmm. I just said mortuary. Well, of course, that's where this movie is set, mostly in that abandoned mortuary. And it's fitting that a massacre occurs in a place of death.
And that's where Mr. White brings Mr. Orange, even though he's promising he's going to live. It's like, no, I'm not going to take you to the hospital. We're going to get you taken care of, but we just got to go to this place first, and it's a mortuary.
Which is presumably where almost all of them die. Except Mr. Brown and Mr. Blue. We never find out what happens to Mr. Blue. There's got to be a meme online by somebody who's a big fan of this movie. He's the real rat. Well, of course, Mr. Orange is. But he's also a rat, because Eddie Bunker, who has one of my favorite lines in the whole movie, actually, during the opening diner sequence when he's talking about how he fell out of Madonna after the Lucky Star phase or something like that. This old guy who's an actual criminal. Eddie Bunker went to jail.
Yeah.
And he wrote the book that became a movie called Straight Time that Dustin Hoffman was in the late 70s. That he actually cared about Madonna is very amusing to me. But he never makes it out. Apparently he's dead as Dillinger. And we see Mr. Brown die in the car after he's been shot in the head, I guess. It's really not entirely clear how he dies. And the sequence where Mr. White shoots all those cops coming at them. But everybody else we care about ends up in that warehouse. And except for Pink, seems to be dead. All these men we're talking about. Here's another movie that fails the Bechdel test.
Oh, yeah.
Hugely, because not only are women not talking about men, I did say not twice deliberately. They don't even get a single line of dialogue.
It's a pretty macho film.
Not just macho. It's casually racist, homophobic, and the characters even a little sexist.
I wouldn't call that racism casual.
To them, it's casual.
Okay, to them it's casual, to me it's not, and to Hollywood films it's certainly not.
You know why I say that? Because I remember when this movie was shown by my classmates back in 1993, I think it was, when I went to college. We all had to pick a film and we had to analyze it. We were too young to really know what the hell we were talking about. My group picked this movie. I had seen it once, I liked it. Our teacher put on our test, is this movie racist? I don't think I really got what he meant by that, because I must have overlooked the N-words. They don't overdo it the way that maybe Pulp Fiction and his other movies have done.
Does any character say it except for Mr. Pink? I think it's just Mr. Pink who actually uses the N-word. They all accept what he's saying, but I think he's the only one that actually uses the N-word. And then that's curious, because Mr. Pink is, without question, most people's favorite character, right? Mm. He's also the voice of reason, and it'd be really easy to take his side as he's arguing with Mr. White. Mr. Pink is right. So how do you stop the audience from sympathizing with Mr. Pink? Well, just as you're about to fully come around to his point of view, he starts spewing the most jarring, hateful word in the American lexicon, and he loses the sympathies of the audience. And it works. You can't continue to like somebody when they're saying such heinous shit as he's saying. Of course, it didn't stop him from still becoming far and away the most popular character in this film, and I remember...
Oh, Mr. Blonde.
People like Mr. Blonde, but remember when they did those DVD sets? Mm-hmm. And each character had its own cover.
I bought Mr. Pink.
You bought Mr. Pink, so did everybody else. We were joking about, like, why would you even manufacture anything other than Mr. Pink? Because maybe a couple people will buy Mr. Blonde, maybe a couple people will buy Mr. Orange. But seriously, Mr. Pink was everybody's favorite character. There were t-shirts. People loved him. And a big part of it is Buscemi just being the most charismatic actor. Talk about overcoming bad looks, because the man is... ugly. He's an ugly man, but still women love him. Guys want to be him. He's a movie star. He just has that much charisma and enough to overcome his use of the N-word. And you know how, like, Jason Reitman does these live screenplay yeah. readings? So in 2012, Jason Reitman did a live dramatic reading of the script on stage, but recast it with all black actors.
Except for the guy Randy Brooks plays.
Because he's black in the movie.
He's a white guy.
Yeah, Patton Oswalt plays him. They recast it because he said, critic Elvis Mitchell suggested that it took the source material back to its roots because all the characters already all sounded like black dudes.
When I read that same thing online, I hearkened back to what we had watched a few days before and thought, I guess they're onto something there. I hadn't really thought of this movie as black dialogue, but Tarantino has said in many interviews that he relates to black people in America more than a lot of black guys do. When Spike Lee or Denzel come out against him and his use of the N-word, he'll say, I know those people better than, maybe not that those guys do, like, maybe he hasn't gone that far, but he'll say that he understands people that aren't like him more than most people do. I don't know how he grew up. Maybe he's right, maybe he's not. But he's also taking a trope and he's putting these words in people's mouths who probably would say that. That's the thing I remember from that test in my class when that question was asked. What are these fucking assholes who aren't stupid by any means, but under stressful circumstances when they're angry, gonna say, they're gonna resort to short forms on things, including using racist terms, because that's the way, unfortunately, most people are, especially American people are.
And I disagree with the notion that portraying a racist character makes a movie racist. I don't think the movie's racist. I think the movie has a racist character.
And it's not common anyway. The times I can think of for sure that Mr. Pink says these things are in the car scene. And I do love when Buscemi and Tim Roth are talking about Pam Grier.
Yeah.
And they're talking about these other women who may have played the character. And they're just distracting Nice Guy Eddie in the front seat. Leave me alone, fuck, I'm trying to make a point here. And then you cut to the back seat where those two guys have this shy look and they look at each other but they can't make eye contact kind of thing. It's this cute little thing where they're almost like they're in love for a second. Ah, you made a joke, I made a joke. But as Tarantino does so well in every single movie he's made so far, it detracts from the violence, from the racism, the sexism, or whatever ism you've got by him being funny.
Mm-hmm. And let's talk about the violence, because that was a big criticism of this film as well, that the violence, which actually is... It's not even like it's extreme. You can't really fairly call the violence extreme. It's not more extreme than the average Hollywood movie. Plenty of PG-13 films have far worse violence. What's extreme is the portrayal of the aftermath of the violence and the effectiveness of that portrayal. It gets under people's skin, and some people just can't tolerate it. And it's not that he takes a bullet to the gut. It's that you have to spend most of the movie watching him bleed out and suffer in pain. It's not that Marvin Ash gets his ear cut off. It's that it's done by this cold psychopath who can't be deterred. his very manner is so unnerving because he's so nonchalant about it and cool. Like, you almost like him as a character, but then he does these terrible acts. And because Marvin Nash's performance, what's the actor's name?
Kirk Boltz.
Those screams of agony are very convincing. You don't see what's happening. It's not actually gory. It's unnerving.
If you look at the special edition DVD, or Blu-ray, you will find the deleted scene where they show the ear being cut off, close-up, graphic, and it looks phony. It does not need to be there, and the fact that the camera pans away from it, you don't really see it at all, makes it more effective. Some of those violent moments in the history of movies are hearsay, because in the finished movie, you don't see the ear getting cut off in this movie. In Seven, people apparently insisted to David Fincher, "The head in the box just messed me up, man." You don't see anything in that box. You don't even see blood in that box. Nothing at all. It's because what they describe to you. Just like when Michael Madsen cuts off the ear in this movie, then he comes back into camera with, "Was that as good for you as it was for me?"
And taps
talking in the ear. Did you hear that? It's awful, but that's what makes it work so well. But then also, when he's about to light the guy on fire, because of all the gas, it pulls the tape off his mouth because of all the watery effect. Nash says, "I got a kid at home." And apparently that really messed up Michael Madsen. The actor, never mind the character, and he almost couldn't finish the scene.
It was an ad-lib, and that almost stopped him dead. But you certainly don't see it in the finished film. You just see this cool-as-ice guy about to light this man on fire. And it's such an intense scene, because you really believe that this might happen. At this point, you really believe anything could happen, because this movie has set you up to expect anything. The terror when you're first watching it is real, and it's funny, I only thought about this now after I've seen this movie, I can't even tell you how many times, and it never occurred to me before that Madsen being where he is, about to light this guy on fire, and he's certainly not in a hurry, he's enjoying himself, he's taking his time, there's no way he wouldn't have noticed Mr. Orange turn around and point a gun at him. There's no way that would have caught him by surprise, because it's right in his sight line. He wouldn't have missed it.
I'll let that slide in movie language.
You let it slide because
he would have been maybe faking that he was as hurt and as passed out as he was. He pulls the gun quickly and shoots the guy who's paying attention to this guy who's pleading in front of him. I think that's not such a big deal.
And you forgive it because movies make all kinds of little mistakes like that all the time. And if you are captured by the action, as let me tell you, you are in this film, in that moment you are at the edge of your seat.
Because also the music that he starts on a radio stops as soon as the song is over. Stuck in the Middle with You. Just like in Pulp Fiction 2 years later, they committed to a song, "Girl, You'll Be a Woman Soon," where Uma Thurman's singing along. Michael Madsen's singing along to Stuck in the Middle. So I guess they were committed to using that song because it's in the scene itself. But the most infamous scene in this movie, the ear-cutting scene, leads into our big reveal of who actually is the Rat.
And I love that scene for a couple of reasons. One, because it actually surprised me the first time I saw it. And like I told you, I was 15. Maybe you can see a broadcast a mile away, but I didn't. But I love that Marvin Nash knew the whole time and remembers him, and Freddy doesn't even remember him. And then you're that much more heartbroken than Marvin Nash is.
I think one of the reasons why that's the case is that Freddy's more experienced in the police force, for one thing. And also, they would have been told, all of them would have been told, Nieuwendyk is our man on the inside.
Yeah.
So why would some regular beat cop who happens to be caught by Mr. Blonde be as informed or as important as the guy who is therein? But I think you're right, actually, as I recap the moment in my head. You're right, it's a nice touch that these guys are having this human moment. I don't remember that at all. I do.
I know, and it just gives you just enough information about Nash as a cop to make it that more heinous that he gets unceremoniously shot to death later.
Yeah, he's still living there. In a lot of movies, he would somehow survive, deformed and tortured that he was. But then just, what, this cop? Bang, bang! Nice guy, Eddie, finishes him off right before the big Mexican shootout at the end of the film.
Speaking of gunshot deaths, we talk about how Mr. Orange took a bullet to the belly, but we haven't mentioned yet, after he takes that shot, he kills a civilian. And you could say, okay, it's self-defense, but he's a cop, and he kills a civilian.
Who shot him first, and also he has this trait. When he shoots Mr. Blonde, he keeps on doing it. I can't do it in the podcast because you can't see me. But the raising of the gun after he's shot, kind of that phantom sort of, you know, Bev can see me.
It's like he's traumatized by his own actions.
Like he's still shooting.
He's stunned.
Without actually shooting anything.
Yeah. It affects him greatly. He doesn't like to take life. I think he kills that woman who they carjack, realizes immediately what he's done and how he's past a point of no return. So part of him confessing to Mr. White at the end is he probably knows that he's either going to die or he's going to go to jail because he's not going to get away with killing that carjacker.
I don't think I can really be proven that he did anything in that instance. And also, I think you could say he's so in character, he is Marlon Brando, that he has now gotten to the point where, this woman shot me, fuck her, I'm going to shoot her in the guts. But also, if he doesn't, then Mr. White does. She's dead regardless.
That may play in movie language, but I think in the courts, that's not how it would go down.
Who could prove that they actually were the ones that hurt her? Oh, they took her car. But then the cars get ditched. Who can prove who killed this woman?
Okay. At any rate, he maybe doesn't forgive himself. I think he is supposed to, as a character, have passed a point of no return and regret that action greatly.
That could be. Okay, we're talking about shooting, so let's get to the end of the movie. This is not a controversy, even though Tarantino himself says, who shot Nice Guy Eddie? And they had shirts made up for that. Look at the fucking movie, frame by frame, at DVD and Blu-ray. It's so easy to do this. I did this on videotape back in the day. Mr. White shoots Joe after Joe shoots Mr. Orange. And the Nice Guy Eddie shoots Mr. White. Who shoots Nice Guy Eddie? Mr. White turns. Okay, they didn't make the guns work effectively enough because it's a low-budget movie and they could have done this digitally so easily. Mr. White shoots one guy, he gets shot, but he's still got enough strength to turn and shoot the other guy. That's who killed Nice Guy Eddie. But it is the first version of Quentin Tarantino's often-used Mexican standoff ending.
I'm not nearly as scandalized by this as other people seem to be. The doubts of who killed who.
This is not part of the mystery whodunit. The guy who shot him
is right on the screen. By then I'm so invested. Yeah, okay, I'll go with it.
People say Mr. Pink maybe did it, but Mr. Pink is hiding under that loading dock thing, getting out of the way, and then takes the diamonds, tries to get away. And if you listen closely, and I've done this before, I actually listened to my front left speaker years ago on the DVD, forget the Blu-ray, which we did watch. You can hear all kinds of shots, and then, stop, buddy, get out of the car, you want to get shot and killed? If you listen very closely, I didn't quite hear this, you can hear Mr. Pink saying things too. So he's captured but not killed. If they want to do another movie on this, everybody else is dead but not him, so they could do a Mr. Pink sequel maybe. But nobody else, because everyone else we care about, maybe not Mr. Orange, actually. Did he survive another shot? Because Mr. White seems to have killed him before he gets shot.
Mr. Orange is dead. But Mr. Pink is alive because he's a professional.
Also, a dispute in this movie is people will say that, just like Pulp Fiction is nonlinear, this is not nonlinear. It's just that they show flashbacks, and sometimes flashbacks within flashbacks.
But isn't that technically nonlinear?
No, nonlinear is when you show things way out of order. This is just introduce a character, and then we see Mr. White meeting with Joe. We see Mr. Blonde meeting with Joe. We see Mr. Orange having his meeting also with Joe, and Mr. White and Nice Guy Eddie in a bar. But that's where the flashback and the flashback comes, because, actually multiple times, because it's, did you tell the commode story? And then you see Randy Brooks explain the commode story, and then you see him telling the commode story, and that phony story, and that's another great moment of tension with the cops in the bathroom and the dog. It isn't even real within the context of what is already a fake movie, but great tension. He's got drugs in his bag, and then he just very calmly, and you like that emotion where he uses the handgun, literally hand.
Finger gun.
Right, pushing the door closed before he does the whole Beretta speech in his own apartment. And he does the same thing with the dryer in that sequence. But none of that's even real. It's just a story he's made up. But that is flashback to flashback to flashback.
It's much easier to follow than Pulp Fiction. Pulp Fiction is intentionally confusing, and you have to pay attention and kind of like work your brain to follow it. Whereas with Reservoir Dogs, it's really not a struggle. I love that bathroom scene. I always remember that from the first time I saw it. It's the most stylish, show-offy scene in the film, for sure, but hella worked on me then, and it still works on me. I still think it's so charming.
And it establishes this character who has got to get in big with these gangsters who don't know him at all. He's the only one I was 100% on.
And it's kind of a great, surreal representation of telling stories, making shit up on the fly, and he's telling the story to the cops and Tarantino. He's okay with us remembering that we're watching a film. Good for him, because I think it helps him, especially in the style that he works in and what he does well. That's how he makes interesting films.
Yeah.
He's never going to really get us inside the heads of his characters. That's not what he does best.
Not in this movie especially.
Yeah.
So speaking of the characters, that is the cast. Around 7 actors in this movie were also in Pulp Fiction. Keitel and Roth, but also Burr Steers has a role in both films. He's the guy who's on the couch who gets shot by Jules in the opening scene, or the early scene, at least, in Pulp Fiction. Lawrence Bender has small roles in both movies. He's a producer on both movies and in so many Tarantino movies. And then a guy named Rich Turner, who is one of the cops in that bathroom sequence, and he's also in Pulp Fiction. I think he's a voice in that movie.
And, of course, Buscemi.
I didn't mention Buscemi, of course. Yeah, plays the waiter. And that's funny, too, because he has that famous speech at the beginning. I used the Tarantino version for the sponsor, but it's the whole, I don't tip, tipping for the birds. And he does make a convincing argument, although the whole thing about how, why you don't tip people at McDonald's, I've always said the reason why you don't tip people at McDonald's compared to people at a restaurant is that you don't have to do anything in a regular restaurant when you sit down. They're bringing you everything. McDonald's, hey, I'm not doing much. But I do have to go get my order. I do have to bust my own tray. At least I should, if I'm not a fucking asshole, bust my own tray into the garbage can. At a restaurant, they're doing everything for you. So that's maybe why you tip them. But isn't it funny that he has this whole speech against waiters, and then in Pulp Fiction, he's a waiter.
He's a disgruntled, rude waiter, as I recall.
As we said on that podcast, probably would have been Jimmy, but he couldn't commit to the movie enough, so he had to take a smaller role. But at least he's in Pulp Fiction, so he did make the top 100 project. Michael Madsen as Mr. Blonde is as cool as it gets in this film, Vic Vega. This should have made him a star, and it didn't really do that. He is in Hateful Eight, and he's been in some other Tarantino films, including Kill Bill. But this could have been Matt Dillon or Christopher Walken. Those two were far bigger names at the time, and maybe far bigger names since then, but I think they got lucky with this, and Madsen was probably the better choice.
It's really impossible to imagine Mr. Blonde as anybody but Michael Madsen. I don't understand why, but I have never seen Michael Madsen be good, even adequate, in a film that wasn't directed by Quentin Tarantino. Except maybe Thelma and Louise. He's definitely adequate in Thelma and Louise, but he is amazing in Tarantino films, and like, I just adore him as Bud in the Kill Bill movie, in Kill Bill Volume 2. He's only in the second one. He's a little bit...
For seconds.
Yeah. And he has the best line in both Reservoir Dogs and in Kill Bill. In Kill Bill, it's wakey wakey. Eggs and Bakey. And the best line he had in Reservoir Dogs was nominated for the AFI's Top 100 Quotes, which was, your turn, you'll do better than me anyway.
Are you going to bark all day, little doggy, or are you going to bite?
Ah, God.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. I said, and he says it again.
I love it. Oh, God, I love it. That moment, he's got a soft drink in his
hand. And that's where the N-word comes out, too, because Mr. Pink says something about how, you guys are going to fight all day, like a couple of N-words, But he's great in this film. You said Mr. Pink. If I had to say who was the iconic character, I would have thought it was Madsen's character as Mr. Blonde. But they're both great. As is Mr. White. Keitel's fantastic, too. He's probably really the lead. It's only that it's Tim Roth because he is the one the movie focuses around more so and has probably the most screen time overall because he has so many of those flashback scenes.
And he would, like, technically, in the traditional sense, be the good guy because he's the cop trying to bring down criminals. We're supposed to root for him.
And those two criminals he's trying to bring down, at least the kingpins, Chris Penn, has had some interesting roles, but he's dead now, unfortunately. He died pretty young. He is, in that opening sequence, of course they all are, but Madonna is that big speech. At one point, his sister-in-law was Madonna.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Because Sean Penn was married to Madonna back in the 80s. This is probably his best role. This and Footloose. They have no connection, but he's great in Footloose, too. I've seen the remake. It's okay. Miles Teller, who we love in Whiplash and so many other good movies, plays the same character, but Chris Penn's way better because he's so inadequate in that role of a dancer, a guy who learns how to dance. And of course, Chris Penn actually had to learn how to dance, and he does it very well. This is the polar opposite character, and it's probably his best work overall. Didn't do a lot of great movies. Lawrence Tierney did, though, maybe not great movies actually, but a lot of crime films. The guy was ancient by this point, but he's well cast because he is the old criminal.
Yeah.
This guy was an actual legitimate psycho. He had problems with Tarantino on set. He started fights with people. His Simpsons appearance, so many people have been on The Simpsons. He is the guy in the episode where Bart steals the video game, Don Brodka, the store security. He has this weird sequence where he actually calls the Simpson family but gets the answering machine. He didn't understand that sequence. They talk about it on the commentary on The Simpsons DVD where they had to just explain to him, and I think they had to lie to him about what they're actually doing to make it work, because the joke is that he has the sequence where he sounds like he's talking to Marge, but then nobody's actually on the phone. This guy did not get the modern era, I guess, at all, because he started in the 40s. He fucked up his lines in the movie. You see it in the making of documentaries. But then a lot of these guys did. In the final product, there's a lot of times where they seem to stumble a little bit, and it kind of works in a way. It's almost like people don't say the line properly. How many times do we fuck up in regular life? We do it all the time. In movies, most of the time they get the actual perfect take. Tarantino went with the, he didn't say it quite right. And maybe he had to settle because of the fact they had no budget. They probably had budget problems, partly because Lawrence Tierney took so goddamn long to get through his sequences, but he was well cast. And we mentioned some of the other supporting characters. Of course, Tarantino's Mr. Brown, Eddie Bunker is Mr. Blue, Kirk Baltz and Randy Brooks, and that's pretty much the cast. Keitel, Roth, and the rest, of course, too. And Tarantino, we covered him in Pulp Fiction several weeks ago. His crowning achievement, the guy's made, is it 8 films officially? If we're going to consider Kill Bill 1 movie, which he does, it's bullshit, it's 2 movies. Okay, maybe 9
I disagree,
movies.
I say it's bullshit, it's 1 movie.
Okay, well, 8 or 9 movies.
Yes.
He has said, if his worst movie is Death Proof, he can live with that. I agree with that.
I agree.
Probably his worst movie. It's still goddamn good, especially in the stunt level.
I know I'm a total Tarantino fan, but I think people need to give Death Proof another chance because, first of all, it's better on the second viewing for reasons that are too boring to explain here in podcasts about a different movie. Also, because, goddamn, that car chase in the end is totally worth the wait.
So much of it is real because Zoe Bell is a stunt person actually playing an actor, and she's done some acting, quite a bit of it, actually, since this movie. And how about Kurt Russell finally getting back into things? Because he hadn't done a big movie, and that really wasn't a big movie either, I guess, but he's working with Quentin Tarantino and Rosario Dawson.
And he nails it!
And he is in The Hateful Eight. Roger Avery, who co-wrote, well, he gets story credit on Pulp Fiction. He helped with some background dialogue in this movie. A lot of it is the Stephen Wright, Gay Billy Super Sounds of the 70s. Just like Richard Linklater last week with Before Sunrise, there's a lot of long takes, and Tarantino does a lot of those in his movies in general. We mentioned the trunk shot, some of the things that he was just experimenting with, and he got to be better and better as he went along.
Yeah, playing with time, the dialogue, the Mexican standoff.
There was a thing online lately, and I'll try to find the clip for it, by the Screen Junkies guys, where they debated the best Tarantino movies. I'm not going to give away what they picked as number one. I'm not saying this is his best movie, but they made the point when Reservoir Dogs was brought up about how he wasn't as good a director then. Of course he wasn't, but when you see how young and inexperienced he was with not the best actors you'd ever get of all time, good cast for sure, great cast actually, but when you compare the biggish budget stuff he gets now, and he can get any actor he wants, versus back in these days, considering all those factors, this movie holds up with the other ones, I think, extremely well.
Yeah, if you were going to make a list of filmmakers' best debut films in history, this would be in the top 20.
Yeah, and I guess it isn't technically his first film. It's something else he called My Birthday something or other. But no one ever saw the movie. Yeah. I think actually he buried it himself. Yeah, so this is thought of as his debut.
Nobody considers that part of his canon. Mm-hmm. Reservoir Dogs is his first film that he owns. Fine, he made something that was kind of practiced before, but most people consider this his first movie, and what a hell of a first movie.
And you said about authenticity earlier, he did it in Pulp Fiction 2 when you have the Butch and Marcellus shootout, where everything seems so real. You hear people shrieking in the background, "I've been shot!" And just like Mr. Pink in this movie where he's trying to get away from the cops, Tarantino makes violence in city streets feel real because of all that. The people screaming, the guns going off, things aren't going the way you want them to. People just barely get away from the person that's shooting at them.
And that's why I call bullshit for people who criticize the violence in the film. I understand if you're a person that just doesn't have that type of sensibility. As Tarantino says, some people just can't tolerate the violence and the bad language, and that's fine. Everybody doesn't have to like his films, but you can't criticize them for being that way as if that's a flaw of the film. I think he does it really well. He does it differently now in his newer films. There's no doubt about that. It's much more cartoonish.
Okay, so the producers, Lawrence Bender, Harvey Keitel was a co-producer, Richard Gladstein, who Tarantino has credited for helping his career so much, and the Monty Hellman, a 60s film icon, all were involved as producers on this picture. The tech people, first of all, cinematographer Andres Shakula, I say that name right? He shot Pulp Fiction also. His movie was 2-3-5-1. We watched the Blu-ray. This movie's never going to be the best-looking film of all time, but it was pretty damn solid. I remember the DVD I had a long time ago. The blacks looked like shit, actually, so they seem to have fixed that. There must be 75 versions of this movie on DVD and Blu-ray now. It is rivaling the Rocky series for how many releases it's had in various formats. Sally Menke, again, was his editor. She did cut Pulp Fiction and all the Quentin Tarantino movies up to and including Inglourious Basterds before she unceremoniously died. And there is no composer because Tarantino often uses no composer, just like on Pulp Fiction. But there is Stephen Wright's Super Sounds of the 70s.
There's one hell of a soundtrack. That's another one of the very Tarantino touches of this film is the Tarantino soundtrack. Have we not really talked about this yet? He uses these obscure, silly, forgotten songs and juxtaposes them with the violence and the terror. And it could have been jarring and annoying, and it certainly has been since in some of the films that have tried to replicate his style, but he really makes it work.
I think the soundtrack is just as good as Pulp Fiction's, if not better.
Both of those were CDs that I owned and that I played to death, and me and my friends knew all the words to those songs. Yeah, you could say they were hits, whatever, but only someone alive in the 70s could have possibly recognized more than a handful of those songs before they heard them in this soundtrack. And this film made classics out of a few of them, especially Stuck in the Middle, which I'm sure I heard before I saw this movie, but it was not a hit. It was never like a commonly played song. Now it's a total wedding band standard.
It hooked on a feeling. Wait. It reached up to number 5 in April of 1970.
Okay, but if you weren't alive in 1970, chances are you had not heard. There are just those songs that live in their time, and then when you do hear them, they take you right back to that place. But now, when you do hear the song, it takes you right back to that scene. The song is, in a way, almost ruined by that scene. Another good example is Hooked on a Feeling. I never heard that song before this movie, and then it got picked up by Alan McBeal. It made it a big part of their show, and now it was in Guardians of the Galaxy. It's considered a classic now, but I don't think it would be had Tarantino not picked it up and put it in this movie.
KBI, LOI, Home of Rock. Okay, the influence from Reservoir Dogs is considerable. First of all, it's inspired by City on Fire, although Tarantino has denied that. But I do read online that he may have ripped it off, but then this guy is the king of homages. Kansas City Confidential, a crime film from the 50s, which I've seen, and The Killing, which is a very famous Kubrick film. Well, not the most famous Kubrick film, but definitely he's influenced by those pictures, as he is by the taking of Pelham 123, the original, because those guys use colors as their names because they're under code. Much like this. You're not Mr. Purple, you're Mr. Purple. Another job, you're Mr. Pink! And the whole reference to, we're supposed to be fucking professionals, refers to professionalism in a lot of the Howard Hawks films, and that's one of Tarantino's favorites, especially in Rio Bravo, one of Tarantino's absolute favorite movies, as he said many times in many places.
So after Tarantino got famous and became this wunderkind of Hollywood, he got a lot of backlash for the fact that he borrows from all these other films, but I've always strongly rejected the idea that he's a plagiarist. Every artist borrows and builds on the ideas that exist in culture already. Look at Scorsese. He's always making direct homages to other films that he loves, and the same with Spielberg. And George Lucas straight up ripped off Flash Gordon when he was making Star Wars, and everybody considers it genius that he borrowed from that. For some reason, Tarantino gets treated like he's just a ripoff artist. I think he only gets that backlash because he gets all this credit for breaking the mold and being so unique and original. If he had created just a cookie-cutter gangster film, nobody would have given him a hard time about it. I mean, people actually make remakes and don't get as much flack as Tarantino got.
I'm going to quote Francis Ford Coppola when he did Inside the Actor's Studio, when he said he appreciates that kind of thing because, of course, he made the Godfather movies and they're imitated by a ton of people. That influenced actual gangster culture in reality. If that guy's okay with somebody ripping off his movie, in fact, is saying, go ahead, be influenced by it. I was influenced by actual artists and other filmmakers before me. That I think it's okay to do it. If you do it well. If you don't do it well, maybe people will stop going to your movies. And Tarantino does the ripoff thing, if you want to call it that. The homage thing, at least.
Yeah.
As well as anybody ever has. Certainly in the modern era. When we did our top tens, when we did the wrap-up, as I said then, is subject to change. I think the only movie I picked from the modern era, at least from the 90s and beyond, that made my top 10 of AFI films was Pulp Fiction. And that movie is filled with all kinds of homages, ripoffs, whatever you want to call it.
It's also one of the most exciting, new, and unique films that were made in the 90s. His homages are more cosmetic. The names of the characters, a particular bit of blocking or cinematography, but his structure and tone are so fresh and daring.
I'm not so sure the average audience member would recognize
the
colors thing from the taking of Pelham 123, which was 20 years before this movie. They did a remake, but that was well after this film. No one's going to care about that. If you do it well, that's what it comes down to in the end. As I've said many times, maybe you agree with me on this, if you want to make something funny that isn't inherently funny and you do it well, then it's fucking funny!
Yeah. Also, Tarantino gives credit where it's due. He doesn't pretend that he's coming up with these ideas on his own. He will absolutely give credit to where he got them from.
Yeah.
Kill Bill's a great example. He has that Twisted Nerve song. He has the nurse costume. It's a direct reference to I can't remember the name of the film because it is somewhat obscure. But anybody who's a real film nerd would recognize that he's not trying to pretend that he came up with this idea himself. He actually wants to draw attention to this piece of work that he enjoyed so much that he wanted to put it in his film.
Uma Thurman's outfit is a reference to a Bruce Lee film from the 70s. Game of Death, I think it's called. Blatantly. Absolutely blatantly.
I mean, the man is a massive film fan. He would put anybody else to shame.
Okay, the awards and AFI list section is a little bit bigger than we've had the first couple weeks of the Next 100 project. No Oscar nominations, and it also was not nominated for the 1998 or 2007 AFI Top 100 lists. But it was nominated for these lists, didn't make any of them. Top 100 Thrills, Top 100 Genres in the Gangster category, the Top 50 Villains, Mr. Blonde, the Top 100 Quotes, we said already, Are You Gonna Bark All Day, Little Doggy, Are You Gonna Bite, and the Top 100 Songs with Stuck in the Middle with You. Any one of those would have been a reasonable choice for those various lists. All right, we've gone a little longer than we have the last couple weeks of the new version of our Top 100 project. But what are your final thoughts on Reservoir Dogs?
I was afraid that going back and revisiting it with a really critical mind was going to show me that I had overestimated the value of this film when I was young and naive and new to film fandom. But on the contrary, it reminded me what a great piece of art it really is and what a phenomenal first film it was for Quentin Tarantino.
It's a great piece of work. And one thing I almost forgot to mention before we wrap, I gotta say this part. For those who haven't heard, a lot of film fans probably heard this story. Where does the name come from? What does it mean? When Tarantino worked for Video Archives, of course, he was a video clerk before he was anything else, watching movie after movie after movie. Either he or one of the other guys in the store suggested to a customer to rent Au Revoir Les Enfants. And the customer apparently said, I don't want to watch no Reservoir Dogs. Hence, Reservoir Dogs.
I find that story just ever so slightly disappointing because I was hoping the title would have more meaning.
Maybe they're all just Reservoir Dogs, where they all end up in the reservoir. Their way or the highway. Okay, big thumbs up, great film. I'll watch it plenty of more times. I've already seen it probably 6 or 7. Well, keeping up with the violence theme, up next on the Next 100 Project is Bev's fourth and final selection in the month of Bev, and certainly the darkest of her quartet, Paul Thomas Anderson's There Will Be Blood.
Two films in a row whose main characteristic could be described as the interesting dialogue to a film that has virtually no dialogue in the first 20 minutes and is a much more visually told story and, in my opinion, Paul Thomas Anderson's masterpiece, unless he ever tops it someday.
We will save other thoughts for next week. Yes. So, the coming attractions trivia. Daniel Day-Lewis, of course, his star, has acted in about 20 films, but has only worked with two directors more than once. Who are those two men?
Alright, I do not know that off the top of my head. I will have to look it up. And if you would like the answer to that question, please tune in to next week's podcast. If you can't wait till next week to listen to our podcast, please visit our website. We've got lots of fun stuff for you guys. It is top100project.com.
Our revamped website.
Yes, we cleaned it up for you guys, and we have a new and improved website for you to visit, so please go check it out.
Much easier to find the backlog podcast from yes. the 60s and stuff.
Yes, now that we have like a roster of well over 100 podcasts, it's a lot easier. And speaking of our well over 100 podcasts, if you are new to us, we have a list of our AFI's top 123 films that made the two lists that are there for your listening pleasure. You can also find them at Podomatic, top100project.podomatic.com, or the easiest way is you could go to iTunes and just search for Top 100
subscribe.
Project. And please, while you're there, subscribe.
Motherfucker, subscribe.
And rate and review us. It helps other people find us. And while we're at that, if you would like to love us back and send us a tweet, I am at Bev Ellis. Ellis Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or if you would prefer to message us privately, we always love to hear from you guys. Our email address is top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And before we go, we have to warmly thank our sponsor, sparkplugcoffee.com.
Okay, ramblers, let's get rambling.
And cut.